Good evening, everyone. Matt's going to bring his message for us tonight from 2 John. So I'll read that. It's only a very small book, just one chapter. You can find it in your Bibles. It comes right after 1 John and before 3 John. And it's actually right up the back, or towards the back of the New Testament. There's just 3 John and Jude and then Revelation. So if you're hunting for it, it's right up towards the back. It's widely accepted it was written by John the Apostle, who also wrote the epistle that Bruce read from earlier. And it's to John as a letter to a church that he's written. So to John, let's listen to God's word. The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, in truth and love. I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. And now I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but the one we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, so that you should walk in it. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch yourselves, so that you may not lose what we have worked for, but may win a full reward. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Though I have much to write to you, I would rather not use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to come to you and talk face to face, so that our joy may be complete. The children of your elect sister greet you.
Check that the is the mic. Well, let me add my greeting to Bruce's. Welcome to church this evening. And I want to start with an observation that I think is true, and that is that our society is fundamentally confused when it comes to the matter of truth. Plain and simple, the truth of the matter is we don't know what to think of when it comes to the word true and truth. And I've had two recent experiences which I think kind of validate this observation. And I like to think of it as a cultural identity crisis, a cultural personality split, a cultural schizophrenia. Well, let me try and make the point. So the first observation, Manj and I have started watching a TV series fairly recently called Making a Murderer. And hands up if you're watching that or have heard of that. A few hands. Well, it is a cultural tour de force at the moment, apparently if you're under the age of 30. It's on Netflix, that might be the reason. Apparently about every second one of my friends is watching it at the moment. And what's it about? Well, I'm not going to give too much of the plot away. It follows the court case of a man called Stephen Avery in Manitowoc County, Wisconsin, North America. He's a man that in the 1980s was convicted of rape, in prison for 18 years, and then exonerated via DNA evidence, proved to be innocent and released. But the focus of the TV series is not on that, because his release is short-lived, to say the least. After about 12, maybe 18 months, he's back behind bars, this time accused of a murder. Now, I haven't finished the series, but I'm 100% convinced that it's a murder he did not commit. So you've got a case of him being in jail 18 years for a rape he didn't commit, and then being in bars, staring down the barrel of a life sentence. And a life sentence in Wisconsin is a proper life sentence, your whole life, for another crime he didn't commit. And what keeps me enthralled, what keeps a fair percentage of Australia enthralled? Well, I would say that it's our deep and abiding sense of right and wrong, what it means to be guilty, what it means to be innocent. as you see what appears to be an innocent man accused for the second time of a crime he didn't commit, you feel righteous indignation, you feel frustration, you feel anger, you feel pathos towards the man. Your heart yearns for his freedom. And it's not just me, it's popular that the rest of the culture gets that as well, I think. You see, when it comes to matters like this, then truth, then facts still matter in our world and in our culture. That's one half of our split personality. Let me give you the other half. Well, I came across the case only a couple of weeks ago, the curious case of Stefonky Walsh, or Walsh in Canada. Hands up if you've heard of Stefonky Walsh. That does not surprise me. Anyway, let me give you a bit of information about this. It's not a court case, but I'll call it a case. And you'll see why in a moment. Well, Miss Walsh is a 6-year-old girl living in Canada. At least that's what Miss Walsh is in her head. And that's how her adopted parents are treating her. But in real life, she is very much a he, and his name is Paul Walsh. He's a father of 7, a family of 10 who he deserted 6 years ago to pursue his dream of being a woman, and then his dream of being a 6-year-old girl. This is 100% true. It's happening in Canada right now. And if that doesn't sound crazy enough, and it does sound crazy enough, he's being hailed by many on the internet as being courageous, of being daring. Why? Well, because he's pursuing his true identity, his true self. He's looked inside himself, worked out the truth of the matter, and the truth of the matter is that he is a 6-year-old girl. Now, obviously, this is an extreme, even absurd example, but extreme and absurd examples abound. And it abounds in a world where the truth is often not a matter of fact, but rather a matter of personal preference or opinion. The fact, the physical facts of Paul's body have been replaced by his fervent desire, his construction, his construal of himself as a woman, and our culture says that's okay. Turns out, Paul, you're actually Stefonky, you're 6 years old, not 52, you don't have 7 kids anymore, you're not a man. John wants to become June, and even though as far as physical facts are concerned he is John, the culture says it's okay for him to be June. And let me, a wily social observer, Carl Truman, has made this comment, which I'm going to share. If everything else which shapes our identity can now be determined by mere personal preferences, why single out age as an exception? If the facts of our physicality can be overwritten by our opinion of what should be true, why not my age too? Why can't I not be 31 but 15? If you call me 31, you're being a chronological bigot. And so we have our two cases which I think demonstrate the split personality, the schizophrenia. You've got the Walsh case and the Avery case. See, in the Avery case, facts still matter to society. It is significant that an innocent man might be put in jail for the rest of his life for something he factually did not do. But then applying the logic of the Walsh case for a moment, spare a thought for that poor person that set up Stephen Avery. You see, that man or woman, they clearly want Avery to be imprisoned for the crime he didn't commit. The true yearning in their heart is for him to be guilty of something he's factually innocent of, but in their heart he should be guilty. And so why doesn't their desire for Avery's imprisonment override the facts of the case? Because the fact of Avery's innocence is no more a fact than Paul Walsh's age or gender. Well, you might say the cases are different. One's a personal choice, a personal preference. The other has far-reaching implication. It ruins another man's life. Well, both have their victims. How much more Paul Walsh and his wife and 7 children have been abandoned for this ludicrous interpretation of the truth? I can't see any reason to distinguish the two, as far as I can tell. Now, perhaps you're confused at this point, and I'm probably not explaining myself clearly, but I kind of want you to be confused, because we are living in a culture of confusion when it comes to the truth. There is a cultural crisis. And so, as is always the case, when there's madness in the society around us, we go back to the Bible to get a reality check. And from 2 John tonight, our passage, we have got 2 points we're going to make. Point one, the truth is a matter of facts. And point two, the truth is more than just facts. Point one, the truth is a matter of fact. Well, 2 John is a really appropriate place to look at this subject matter of truth because John is all about the truth. Check out verse 1 and 2. The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. In fact, the truth is the reason why John writes this letter at all. Well, actually, that's actually not entirely true. In fact, the opposite is true. His reason for writing the letter is a denial of the truth. More specifically, he's warning the elect lady and her child, as Gary pointed out, most likely code for a church. He's warning the church of preachers doing the rounds in their area who deny a very specific truth. And we encounter that truth in verse 7. So have a look in front of you there. For many deceivers have gone out into the world, those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. So what is the truth these teachers are denying? The coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. And the significant bit is the in the flesh bit. Because these people weren't denying there was a Jesus. No, they kind of worked as a full-time occupation preaching Jesus. What they were denying about Jesus was that he was a flesh and blood person. These people, it would appear, came from a school of thought that taught that all flesh was inherently evil and the only spirit was good. And it's a school of thought heavily influenced by a dominant philosophy of the day called Platonism. So I've got it up. There's a lot more you could say about Platonism, but for today we'll just say it has a dislike of the flesh or the physical. They still called themselves Christians, though. Because what they did is they got that Platonism, which dislikes the flesh, they kind of added Christianity to it, Christian teaching. Today we actually call it Gnosticism, you don't need to know the word. But what they taught was that they taught a belief that Jesus was a non-human but divine being. And they dressed it up using scripture to look like that's what the Bible was saying. They were saying the Bible puts him as appearing like a human being, but he actually wasn't truly a human being. And in responding to this teaching, John pulls no punches at the end of verse 7. He calls them deceivers and antichrists. And if you think that's kind of John getting excited on his high horse, check out verse 10. Speaking about these people, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, right, that is the teaching that Christ was a real human being, if they don't bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house or give him any greeting, for whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Now think about the strength of the statements John's making here. He's not just saying don't let this person preach at your church. He's not even saying don't let this person enter through the doors of your church. He's saying that if you run past this person, run into them in the street, don't even extend your hand for a handshake. John wants you to treat them as if they've got an infectious disease. And that's not just antisocial, right? That sounds pretty almost hate-filled. And there's an irony because John is the apostle known as the apostle of love. Look at verse 1. The elder to the lady and her children whom I love in the truth. Verse 3. Grace, mercy and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son in love and truth. In fact, John's the apostle that tells us that God himself is love. So what's he doing with this kind of hate-filled instruction? Does he preach love but actually wants them to practice hatred? No, that's not what's happening here. John offers this harsh advice, this almost cruel-seeming instruction, because he knows what's at stake when it comes to the truth and the truth that they're denying. Look at verse 8. Watch yourselves so that you may not lose what you have worked for, but may win a full reward. John's saying, watch out for this teaching, because if you swallow it whole, you might lose what you've worked for. And what is it that they've worked for? What is their reward at stake? Well, have a look at verse 9. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide, that means remain, everyone who goes on ahead and does not remain in the teaching of Christ does not have God. What's at stake with this truth? It's God himself. Believing the truth or believing the lie here is the difference between having God, having salvation, or not having God, having condemnation. To think back to Stephen Avery and making a murderer, the facts of his case dictated whether he would be imprisoned or freed. Well, the stakes in this matter are eternal imprisonment, eternal freedom. And so why? Why is the denial that of Jesus' humanity, why does that threaten to steal God away from them? Well, because if you take away Christ's humanity, you take away Christ and all his teaching. Because to preach a non-human Christ is to preach no Christ at all. And think about the dominoes as they fall. No humanity means no incarnation. Boom. No incarnation means no life of service. Boom. No life means no crucifixion. Boom. And no bodily resurrection. Boom. It knocks down all the major doctrines in one blow. And not only doctrines, but facts. The fact of Jesus' birth, gone with that. The fact of his crucifixion, got rid of that. The fact of his resurrection, got rid of that. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, take away these facts and you are left with absolutely nothing. You see, the truth of Christ cannot be separated from the facts of his life and teaching. To repeat the point, the truth is indeed a matter of fact. And so returning to John's harsh labels and his harsh treatment he instructs, he says, treat them like an infectious disease, because if the church is infected with their disease, their teaching, which many were back then their relationship with God himself is at stake. Now, kind of fast forwarding 1900 years to us today, what's the relevance? This threat of Gnosticism, if that's what I call it, feels very, very distant and remote, doesn't it? I don't think I've met a Gnostic for many years. I've never met a person who calls himself a Gnostic. I don't think anyone does. See, Gnosticism by name does not exist anymore. But if I've learnt anything from the recent rebranding at Macca's, and I've learnt a lot, it's this. If you change the label but don't change the ingredients, then nothing really changes. A cheeseburger is still a cheeseburger, after all. And the same is true when it comes to false teaching. You won't see teaching in the church using the label Gnosticism, but you will find teaching that uses the very same ingredients. And I'm about to show you how the recipe works behind me. Now, this is probably the second or third time in my life I've used a recipe, so let's hope it goes well. And I've labelled it How to Make a Heresy. Step one, obtain two raw ingredients. You have your major ingredient, which is the popular philosophy of your day, in this case, Platonism, with its dislike of the flesh. And you have your minor ingredient, Christ's teaching. Okay? Got your two ingredients on the table. Step two, you gut the minor raw ingredient, that is, Jesus' teaching. You gut it by removing those facts that don't mix well with your major ingredient, Platonism in this case. So as you get rid of his birth, you get rid of his death, you get rid of where he eats, where he cries, where he suffers, where he's a man at all. Step three, you mix the two ingredients together and bake. Step four, once baked, you remold and reshape the thing that comes out the oven so that it looks like the minor ingredient, Christ's teaching, even though the major ingredient is the popular belief, Platonism here. Step five, you apply the label Christianity, even though its true label is really Gnosticism. Step six, voila, you have a popular teaching of the day that everyone loves because it looks like everything around in them and the world around them, but it smells like Christianity and it will sell like hotcakes. Easy, you can make your own heresy, and I'll show you how in a moment. In fact, I'm going to share with you how this is actually a formula that has been repeated time and time again throughout the centuries. And I'm going to share just two or three that are relevant to us today. How to make a heresy, take two. Step one, obtain two raw ingredients. Major ingredient, popular philosophy, in our case, materialism. And by what I mean by that type of materialism is that buy all the things you can, it's going to make you happy. Minor ingredient, Christ's teaching. Step two, gut mind of raw ingredients, removing those parts that don't mix well with materialism. Get rid of those promises of poverty, persecution, get rid of Christ's suffering if you can, get rid of all the calls to carry your cross, and just sprinkle and emphasise those bits which sound nice. Follow all the other steps. Step five, apply the label Christianity, even though the true label should read the prosperity gospel, and it will sell like hotcakes. Or again, major ingredient, popular philosophy, that's political correctness. The minor ingredient, Christ's teachings. You gut Christ's teachings of all those bits like sin and judgment and commandments, which we don't like to hear. Bake it, you apply the label Christianity, even though its true label should be wishy-washy nothingness religion / liberalism. I think that's all I've got. And all these false teachings across the 2,000 years, you could add countless ones to that. They all wear the badge Christian or Christianity. But they gut Christ's teaching of its significance. They remove all those facts. It's a bit like Paul Walsh or Stefanke. He gets rid of all those inconvenient facts and replaces him with his own agenda and his own spin of what the real truth is. The same is true of heresies in the church. And the result is often full churches, filled with people full of false teaching, who have bought false promises and have a fake Christ. And I don't say this gleefully, but many of whom, on that last day, Jesus will say, "Go away, foolish and wicked servant, for I never knew you. The Christ you thought you knew was not me." Now, going back 1900 years to John's instruction, he's very harsh, but it's not because he doesn't love them. It's precisely because he does love his fellow believers. He moves to protect them from a teaching that threatens to take salvation and God himself from them. And there's a lesson for you and I too, in the way that we act. When the truth like this is at stake, we must be like John, be willing to defend it, even harshly. Surely our love for each other compels us to that. And when we encounter a teaching, whether it be the prosperity gospel or the liberal theology gospel or the gospel of dream fulfillment, when we encounter those false teachings that pit the truth of Christ against the actual facts and truth, we must be willing to call it for what it is, a false Christian with a false Christianity with a false God. And hey, personally to us, many of us who I think do have the right Christian, although we come to the same church, the right Jesus in mind, we've still got to be sure that the Jesus of our heart, the Jesus that we genuinely follow, is not one that suits the fads and fashions or our whims and our desires. But it's a Jesus that is true to Scripture, even when he says things and does things we don't understand. We must chasten our understanding of Jesus to the Bible, to the facts of his life. The truth is, after all, a matter of fact. Point one. Point two, the truth is more than just facts. I might be a bit confusing. I've just said the truth is a matter of fact, and now I'm saying the truth is more than just facts. What do I mean? Well, I mean, having a look before you at 2 John, there's a reason why there's verses 4 to 6 before verse 7. Before John gets to verse 7 and talks to the false teachers, those people that don't have the truth, he wants to speak to those that do have the truth. And importantly, he wants to see how they're responding to it. After all, it's all well and good if you have the truth, but if you act like the truth doesn't matter, then that truth is of no value to you. Let me offer you a crude example that I hope makes the point. And I'm going to carry on the disease imagery. All right, imagine you've just come back from a trek into the jungles of Borneo, trying to catch a tiger or something they have in Borneo. And once you get home, you develop a sickness. And the sickness gets worse and worse and worse. You get transported via ambulance to hospital. And for 6 months, your condition degenerates and degenerates and degenerates. It looks like you're about to die. Then one genius doctor, Overeese, works out what the disease is. Not only that, but he synthesizes a cure. Well, your family celebrate. You celebrate. You have a new lease on life. And they send you home with the cure in your hand, in a little vial. Well, 1, 2, 3 days go past. You make no contact with your family. Everyone thinks, well, in my case, Matt's just resting up. He's always been a bit lazy anyway. I mean, after 4 days, your family says, no, something's going on. Knock on the door, no answer. They bang down the door, and there lies my cold, lifeless body, with my vial containing the cure in my hand. You see, I had the truth right in my hot little hand, or cold, clammy hand, after 4 days, cold hand. But you see, it's more than just having the facts, right? It's more than having the truth. You've got to respond to it. And John wants to know if this church is responding to the truth. Or if we read verse 4, using his language, it's about walking. Verse 4, I rejoice greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as we were commanded by the Father. So John does see some signs of life there. But what does John mean by walking in the truth? What does that look like? Well, in the next verse, in verse 5, the church is told that walking in the truth is about obeying the command to love each other. And then verse 6 tells us that loving each other involves obeying the command again and walking in love. So you've got obedience, command, love, and truth, kind of working as interwoven throughout those verses. In fact, you've got walking in the truth is walking in obedience, is walking in love. When you read the passage, when you spend time, it's actually quite hard to distinguish the difference between the three in John's mind. But there's a good reason why truth, love, and obedience are so closely connected for John, because they are for Jesus as well. After all, the greatest command is our commands, Jesus tells us, is loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and loving others. You see, obedience and love working together. And if you think about it, commands are only commands with any authority if they also are truth. So you've got obedience, love, and truth all working together in those commands. And you must have truth, love, and obedience working together at all times. Why? Well, because truth without love is merely head knowledge. And love without truth may well be misdirected and misguided. And love without obedience, well, that's mere sentiments. And obedience with love, well, that's just heartless legalism. And obedience without truth will likely be misguided. You see, truth, love, obedience, that triumvirate, that three have to work together. Or you could put it like this, true knowledge of Christ motivates true love and affection towards God and towards true obedience towards him. Well, let me try and land this and apply it. I guess what I'm saying is we have to ask ourselves this question. Do we merely have facts about Jesus, or are we responding to them? Are our lives marked by love and obedience to the truth of Christ? Or are our lives more like a heresy? Do they just have the veneer, a thin layer of Christ? But underneath that layer, my true love, my true obedience, my true allegiance is to the teaching of this world, of the gospel of wealth, the gospel of power, the gospel of security, the gospel of reputation, the gospel of success, the gospel of comfort. Are we in danger of always having the truth but never responding to it? You don't want to die with that vial in your hand. Remember John's warning in verse 9. Everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. If your life isn't marked by love, by obedience, by that truth of Christ, then John would ask whether you have God at all. But also remember the words of encouragement, the second bit of 9. Whoever abides in his teaching has both the Father and the Son. If you are walking in the truth, in love, in obedience, if you have a life marked by that service, the love of God and the love of others, then you have the God of the universe as your Father, the Son as your brother. And that will always be the case. And so let me leave by encouraging you, as John encourages us, to continue walking in the truth. Amen.
Fix in us thy humble dwelling, satisfied.